I've been given the pleasure and privilege to introduce our final speaker of the day.
Y'all, please do take a seat. Thank you.
Stephen R. Weissman. You may remember last November, not even a month after the shootings at Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the New York Times book review and a front page review of five new books on the theme, American Jews Face a Choice, Create Meaning or Fade Away. And the lead work in that review was Steve's brand new, The Chosen Wars, which I'm counting on hearing more about today. There was a real buzz. All of a sudden, we were all on email. Have you seen the review? Have you seen the review? What's this new book? And you know, I think the subject matter is what people were focusing on, and I have to say it was kind of the beginning of our thinking about what the theme of this meeting would be this morning. But for me, what was so exciting was that just a few paragraphs down, the reviewer starts quoting Abraham Moniz in 1820, and Isaac Harvey, and Gustavus Poznanski. And there we were. There was Charleston Jewish History. In big, bold letters, the middle of the lead book review. This was a real validation of our work. So, of course, I was interested in the book, and Steve and I became correspondents and got the book. And indeed, one of the things I think you'll hear about is he puts really front and center Charleston and our early reform movement as the beginning of the Americanization of Judaism, which is a theme that I can say we have been harping on since Apportionment of the People. So it was kind of a natural to invite Steve Weissman as our chosen speaker this morning. He was born in Los Angeles, grew up in Beverly Hills, and graduated from Yale University in 1968, so we are definitely of the same cohort. He's probably has the greatest breadth of expertise of anyone we've invited to enlighten us at one of these meetings. And you can read what I'm about to tell you in the program of the magazine, his bio. He's Vice President for Publications and Communications at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Previously served as a correspondent, editor, and editorial board member at the New York Times. I'm sure that had nothing to do with this review.
Nothing.
He was awarded the Edward Weintraub Prize in 2004 from Georgetown University for reporting on the run-up to the Iraq War, and has served as a New York Times bureau chief in Japan and India, as well as senior diplomatic and senior White House correspondent. His book, The Great Tax Wars, Lincoln to Wilson, How the Income Tax Transformed America, 2002, received the Hellman Prize. He was editor of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, A Portrait and Letters of an American Visionary, 2010. The Great Trade-Off, Confronting Moral Conflicts in the Era of Globalization, was published in 2016. But as I say, the book I think we're going to be focusing on today is The Chosen Wars, which is for sale in the lobby. No?
It will be at the bookstore.
It will be at the bookstore.
Beginning Monday.
Okay. Beginning Monday. But with that, without ado, I'd like to introduce Steve Weissman.
Thank you, Gail. You can hear me. I can hear myself. Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor to be here. And it's daunting. I think this is the definition of someone who has a hard act to follow. But I want you to change your frame of mind a little bit from that wonderful exhortation that we heard, and have a conversation with me about my own journey in writing this book, which was really one that derives from my experience as a journalist for the New York Times for many years, and as somebody who brought his own sense of curiosity to American Jewish history and tried to see all sides of how, of the story of how we evolved in the 19th century, especially into the Judaism that we possess and cherish today in America, which I would argue is unique. Judaism has become an American religion, for good or ill. That's the thesis of my book, and that's what I'll talk to you about today. But I think the best way to begin talking about it is to tell you a little bit about how somebody who was a reporter for the New York Times covering politics, economics, presidential elections, wars, I was a foreign correspondent, as Dale said, mentioned the various assignments that I was privileged to have at the Times. I mean, how did I get into Jewish history? And I, something that Dale said last night really resonated with me when she said, in receiving this wonderful award, that it wasn't until she became involved in history and studying history that it kind of awakened her Jewish identity as an adult that perhaps she didn't possess growing up. And that's really true for me. So I grew up in Beverly Hills, as she said, and in a very reform synagogue called Wilshire Boulevard Temple. It was very Hollywood oriented. That, in fact, the sanctuary that was built in the 1920s was financed by Warner Brothers and Irving Thalberg and all these Hollywood figures. And I always like to recall that when I was growing up in the 1950s and 1960s, as you entered the sanctuary in the front, they had on display the actual tablets that were carried by Charlton Heston. So the other thing about growing up in Beverly Hills was that my childhood friend, who I lived down the street from on Spalding Drive, Jeff Greenfield is his name, he and I studied Hebrew together. He was the one who asked me if I wanted to study Hebrew with him. And he was bar mitzvahed, as was I, in a very reform, almost secular environment. And then he's still my dearest, oldest friend. We were friends starting when we were toddlers. He went off to Harvard, I went off to Yale, and then he graduated at the top of his class at Harvard. He's one of the most brilliant people I've ever known, a musician. He's now a pediatrician in Israel. But after he graduated from Harvard, he became very religious, decided to become an Orthodox Jew. He decided to abandon his American identity, and he moved to Israel and studied in a seminary to just change his entire life. And this was such a shock to his family and friends. It was almost as if he had committed a heresy, abandoning his family traditions. And his mother and father were very upset, and his friends were shocked, and I was shocked. But I went off in the early 1970s to visit him in Israel at his invitation, and I spent a couple of weeks at the seminary learning about the Talmud, and you know, I thought, I was shocked at my ignorance. I didn't know about the Talmud. I didn't know the 613 mitzvot that Moses, I thought there were only 10, you know, the 613, and all these things that governed Jewish life. And I was very moved by this experience, as you can imagine, my dear friend. But I never thought it was for me, unlike Jeff. So that started me on a journey to figure out why. Why was it not for me? And if God told Moses all of these commandments, who were the Jews who decided they could say, well, not so much, you know? When did it happen that Jews abandoned these traditions after thousands of years? So I started reading, and I've been reading all of the last 40, 45 years about Jewish history, and particularly American Jewish history. I read about the Enlightenment, I read about the Jews, obviously, in Germany, the great leaders of the Jewish Enlightenment movement, but I really got interested in what was happening in America, because I love American history, and I studied American history in college. And I'd written a book about American history that focused on debates over taxes in the 19th century and 20th century. So I read some of these wonderful scholarly works that were produced by scholars at the American Jewish Archives and Hebrew Union College about the history of the Reform Movement. And I just started reading about these great episodes. And that, of course, led me to Charleston and the great story about Beth Elohim and the fight over the organ, which probably all of you know by heart, but you know that after the big fire in Charleston, when Beth Elohim raised money to reestablish the synagogue, it was decided to install an organ. And the organ was very controversial, and the synagogue split into an organ faction and an anti-organ faction, and they struggled and split apart and came back together again. And as you know, he wasn't really a rabbi, he was the leader of the synagogue, Gustavus Posnansky, at the opening of the synagogue, declared something really amazing, which was that this temple is our temple, not the temple in Jerusalem. This land is our Palestine. This is our homeland. And think of how revolutionary that was. And by the way, Rabbi Posnansky's great granddaughter is here with us, Shannon Spiegel. We've enjoyed getting to know each other the last day or so. She got in touch with me after that New York Times piece. There was another thing that was revolutionary when the Beth Elohim was rebuilt, which was that they had a discussion about posting the 13 principles of Judaism that Maimonides codified in the 12th century. A lot of people thought that that was one of Maimonides' least thought out projects, but he tried, you know, almost in the Christian or Islamic tradition to codify Judaism into principles, which was considered actually rather controversial at the time. So it was the tradition of a lot of synagogues to post these 13 principles in the synagogue, and Beth Elohim decided to post them, but they left out the last three being the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem, that Jews should pray for and Jews should pray for a Messiah, more specifically, to deliver them back to Jerusalem for the rebuilding of the temple, and the dead would be resurrected. So instead of the 13, they posted the 10. This is also very controversial. If you read, you know, the histories of Charleston, there were big debates about it and disputes. But it was the beginning of this idea that Jews belonged here, something that Rabbi Schindler spoke so eloquently about just now, that that Jews decided to become Americans after thousands of years. They were no longer going to pray for their return to Zion, and no longer going to pray for the Messiah. So the other thing that happened here in Charleston, South Carolina, which I loved learning about, was the arrival of Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise in Charleston. He was engaging in a lot of disputes in his synagogue in Albany. He was a visionary but somewhat combustible personality. And he came down here. It's not exactly sure why. He was maybe looking for a job to succeed Poznanski. And he attended a debate here in Charleston over the Messiah. And Poznanski was there, and another rabbi from New York named Morris Rafal, who I'll get to in a second, was here, and they had this big debate about the Messiah. Do Jews believe in the Messiah? And finally, apparently Rafal was losing the debate, and he, in some exasperation, turned to Wise and said, "Do you believe in the coming of the Messiah?" And Wise said, "No." Well, this was reported all over the country in the Jewish press. He was virtually excommunicated by the Orthodox portion of American Jewry, led by another wonderful and amazing, brilliant rabbi named Isaac Leiser, who is less well known than Isaac Meir Wise. They were sort of frenemies. They were respectful enemies or whatever. And Leiser denounced him. He went back to Albany. He was fired on the eve of Rosh Hashanah for a number of, he was fighting with the kosher butcher, he was fighting over Sabbath laws. And maybe many of you know this story, but it's obviously one of the great ones in American Jewish history, that he was fired on the eve of Rosh Hashanah. His supporters told him to come to the synagogue anyway. At the time of the Torah service, Wise went up to the Bima to take the Torah out of the Ark. The president of the synagogue rushed up, grabbed the Torah, slugged him in the face. A riot erupted in the synagogue. The Albany police were called in. It was in all the Albany papers the next day. He was humiliated. He was marched back to his house. He was arrested. He was later cleared. But this was, you know, the great turning point of American Jewish history. The fist fight heard around the Jewish world, and of course Wise, a few years later, left Albany to go to Cincinnati and founded the institutions of Reform Judaism, that including Hebrew Union College and so many other institutions. Now Wise didn't see himself as a quote Reform rabbi. He wanted to be an American. He wanted Judaism to become an American religion, not a Reform religion, but an American religion. And he fought all his life to try to unify Judaism into a single American unified religion. And he failed. And we can see that. He failed. Toward the end of the 19th century, he was fighting on his left and his right, and to his left, people who were much more vigorous reformers, including David Einhorn, who Rabbi Schindler mentioned in her talk, who was calling for more reforms and more calls for social justice, as she pointed out, and then more conservative rabbis who rebelled against that idea. So there are a lot of American Jewish histories. But what I wanted to do was to really write about the battles over religion. You know, we've heard yesterday these wonderful stories about the rise of the merchants. There are so many wonderful cultural and social histories, but I felt that there wasn't a history that really talked about what they were fighting over, religious doctrines and beliefs and practices. So I tell you those stories because they're in my book. They're among my favorite. But it was really when I realized, when I was reading these stories, that I realized maybe I had a book. And that's how I came to write this book. And I talked to my agent in New York and my wonderful editor, Alice Mayhew, who is one of the great nonfiction editors, does a lot of history. She's Gary Wills' editor, and Doris Goodwin, and Bob Woodward. And she is a brilliant advocate of narrative history, and said, you can write this book. And she said to me, this needs to be a book about how everything that comes to America gets changed by America, and that changes America. And that's what I tried to capture in my book. So, let me I want to have a conversation because a lot of you are engaged in this subject. Let me just summarize by saying that there are three main reasons why I think Judaism became an American religion, and that I talk about in my book. The first was practical, and we heard a lot of these practical issues that Jews faced yesterday when we were listening to Professor Whitfield's talk about the peddler classes and the dispersal of Jews in America, and especially in the South. I found that fascinating, that especially that small town dispersal of Jews, that made it, as a practical matter, very difficult for Jews to adhere to their practices, to keep kosher, to keep Shabbat, because there were pressures on them to sell, because they, blue laws kept stores closed on Sunday, so Saturday was the day that they could earn a living to integrate themselves in society, to not be seen as a people apart, to not dress alike, all these practical reasons. If you wanted to have, you know, lunch or dinner with non-Jews, it was just hard to keep kosher. And so there were these practical difficulties that forced Jews to abandon many of their ancient practices that made them so distinctive. But the second factor, of course, was what I call an intellectual one, which is such an exciting thing to read about when you read 17th and 18th century and 19th century history. You know, I was just saying to Dale, I'm starting this new book by Rick Atkinson, just now published, about the Revolutionary War. He's the military historian who's written all these great books about World War II that maybe you've come across, Pulitzer Prize winner, and now he's starting a trilogy on the Revolutionary War, and I'm just reading about the ferment in the 18th century that was underway with Benjamin Franklin, the discoveries through telescopes. I mean, starting with Copernicus and Galileo, yes, but the expanding sense of the world made it of science, of geology, of paleontology that was underway in the 17th and 18th century. It just made it very difficult for anyone who was engaged in the modern world to be to accept the fairy tales of the Bible and of Scripture. So there was a need to read these stories differently, not to overthrow their authority because they have beautiful moral lessons, but rather to not take the stories literally, but to look at the ethical precepts underlying the stories, which the rabbi just was discussing, right? You know, at And then the other thing that was happening in this period, really also by Protestant scholars, was a real, especially in Germany, there was a revival of studying Hebrew among Protestants. I mean, there was a love of Hebrew of scholars in the 18th century, 19th century. My alma mater, of Yale, is the inscription is in Hebrew, and they began to discern the different voices of Scripture, and they began to realize that these were stories told by different people, and that it wasn't dictated by God, and that there were contradictions in the Torah, and that for centuries, for millennia, Talmudic scholars tried to resolve these contradictions by tortuous reasoning about what God may have intended, but always assuming that it was the single voice of God in the text. But the big revolution in the 18th and 19th centuries was seeing the scripture through a different light. And so intellectually, if you wanted to be religious, you had to find your way to a different path to God than just assuming that the world was 6,000 years old. You know, I went to the Museum of Natural History in New York a couple of months ago, and they have this great exhibit there on the history of the Earth, geology. They've really revolutionized that museum. It's very interactive and digital. But there's a little plaque that goes, that's in front of this exhibit that says, until the 1700s, everybody assumed that the world was 6,000 years old. Of course it was. I mean, they knew that there were fossils, but they figured, oh, the fossils must have been destroyed by Noah's flood. You know? So what I'm saying is that this intellectual ferment necessitated a revision of religion. And what I found so intriguing in writing my book and researching it was the voices of people, Jews and non-Jews, who were struggling to reconcile their faith with the modern world and with rationality. And to me, this has resonated because it's what we do every day, all of us, to try and understand these ancient precepts, but that, let's face it, some of them we have to rethink. There are these beautiful passages that Rabbi Schindler cited, but there's also some pretty repulsive ones that are contemporaneous with those beautiful passages of putting to death people who are slaughtering your enemies, putting to death deviant behavior. So picking and choosing, that's a really scary concept in religion, but that's what happened. And that's why I became so fascinated with this period of American history. So there was a third reason, of course, that things changed in America and that changed American Judaism, which was America. Jews wanted Judaism to be a religion, an American religion, and they consciously, here in Charleston and elsewhere, adjusted Judaism and its ideas to conform, if you will, to what other religions were doing. So they introduced concepts like mixed seating, having men and women sitting together. I was just looking at my book. I mean, there was a Unitarian minister here in Charleston, Samuel Gilman, who visited a synagogue and talked about how obnoxious it was. The women were sitting in the balcony like in a chicken coop. And he's one of my favorite characters because I went to Yale, as you know, which as a couple of years ago changed the name of one of its residential colleges to away from Cal. It was called Calhoun, and now they changed the name because of the political correctness. But I noticed that Benjamin Gilman, who was a supporter of slavery, composed Harvard's alma mater, Fair Harvard. Did you know that? And but Harvard hasn't abandoned that yet. Anyway, sorry about that. So they wanted, frankly, Jewish services to resemble more like church services, mixed seating, decorum, standing up at the same time, sitting down at the same time. We've all been to Orthodox shuls where, you know, it's a cacophony of babbling and nobody can understand anything, and people are davening and people are talking. So they said, no, we want to have it nice so that our Gentile friends can see that we're just like them. We're not a weird cult. And so they changed it. They did a couple of other things, though, that happened, which is one of them was that they democratized the structure of Judaism. Synagogues decided that they were going to decide their own practices and not be dictated to by rabbis. If democracy was good enough for the Constitution, it was good enough for the synagogue constitutions. And the other thing that happened that we've noticed, heard both in the lecture this morning and in yesterday, was the rise of secular Jewish organizations that people found fulfillment in, charitable and civic organizations. B'nai B'rith, of course, was the granddaddy of these. But there were so many others. They had their own rituals. The rabbis hated them. They were Masonic. You know, they were Masonic in nature. My dad was president of a Masonic lodge. They didn't wear robes and funny hats, but they were charitable organizations. They were civic organizations, and they competed with the synagogues and forced the synagogues to realize that civic life, as Rabbi Schindler said, was an important part of Judaism. And so now, let me just come back to the issue of the Messiah. I have to confess that I went down sort of a rabbit hole in reading about the Messiah. I read all these books. And by the way, Rabbi Schindler mentioned the American Jewish Archives. I couldn't have written this book without the help of the American Jewish Archives and the great director, Rabbi Gary Zola, who was a distinguished scholar in residence, I think, here when he was writing his biography of Isaac Harvey. And Gary, who I befriended some years ago by accident, because my wife is from Cincinnati, they were having an exhibit, and I visited, and I told him I was thinking of writing this book. And unlike a lot of scholars who might have said, who are you to write this book? You don't have a PhD, you're just a journalist. He said, you can write this book. You can tell the stories and maybe make it more accessible to the average reader. So I love Gary for that. Mm-hmm. I could not have written this book without his help. And he saved me from a lot of mistakes when he read the manuscript. And he was very supportive. And he was very tolerant of my obsession with the concept of the Messiah. Because to me, the Messiah symbolizes everything I'm trying to talk about. Because, first of all, it symbolizes the reading and misreading of text. Because, after all, when Christians read Isaiah, you know what they see in it. They see a prophecy of Jesus. You know, behold, a virgin will conceive, and to produce a son, blah, 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 and his name will be Emmanuel, and he'll be the King of Kings. Well, Jews read Isaiah, of course, as Isaiah saying that one day there will be someone who will come and succeed and resume the line of King David, the Davidian line, which we're all supposed to pray for if we're religious Orthodox Jews still. And so why did they read this into the text? Because for thousands of years, when you believe that the religious authority of text, that it comes from God, essentially you are believe that there are cryptic messages in the text. And so the debate over who will be the Messiah was really, led to the most horrific hatred between Jews and Christians and persecutions, because Jews are supposed to accept Jesus Christ as the Messiah, and after all, it says so in Isaiah. So I wanted to read more and more about why the Jews rejected the idea of the Messiah. And what I found in reading American Jewish history was the beautiful idea that although Jews in America rejected the idea of a personal Messiah, they never rejected the idea of believing in a messianic era, an era of redemption and of peace and brotherhood that is symbolized by the letter from George Washington that the rabbi mentioned this morning, that beautiful letter. And one of the things that she didn't quote was where Washington repeats the messianic view of everyone shall live under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid, which is from Micah, and which, of course, many of you have seen or listened to the music of Hamilton, where they, create a whole song around those beautiful prophetic words. But what you see in the 19th century in America is that, and this happened in Protestantism as well, in the great Second Great Awakening, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and the Transcendental Movement, this moving away from believing in a Messiah or the second coming of Jesus, and believing that an era of justice, and which is symbolized by those beautiful words, will come, but that it has to be brought by human behavior. Now, Rabbi Schindler talked about social justice, and I will be curious to see if she agrees or disagrees with me, but I think, in fact, the idea of social justice is a fairly modern concept. We can find beautiful words in the Bible that talk about justice and treatment of the poor, and no one shall be needy, and all of those things. But the idea of thinking about society, actually the concept of thinking about society as an organism that should adhere to certain norms is a pretty much of an Enlightenment and modern concept. And what happens in the 19th century especially is that religion, Western religion, Protestantism, Judaism, Catholicism, move toward this vision of wedding religious belief to the achievement of social justice. And you see it, of course, in the social gospels of Protestantism and Catholicism. Many of the popes, and a couple of the popes in the 19th century, were big advocates of social justice as a basic tenet of Catholicism. And you see this emerging in Jewish writings in the 19th century. especially in the various platforms and pronouncements as rabbis over the period of the 19th centuries convened. And they evolved this concept that they were always uncomfortable with chosenness, with Jews being the chosen people. For obvious reasons, I think all of us wrestle with that. There's so many passages in the Bible about the special relationship between Jews and God. How are we supposed to think about that, especially as Americans? Do we really think we're superior to other people? What were we chosen for? And the concept evolved in American Judaism in the 19th century that Jews were a messianic people, that they were chosen by God not to be superior, but to deliver a message of belief in God, but also a belief in improving society as a whole. So that this concept that the previous speaker spoke of so beautifully about the role of Jews engaging in social action and in society, it begins to emerge out of these pronouncements in the 19th century. And if you read the text, it's just fascinating. And culminating, of course, in the in what maybe many of you know is the famous Pittsburgh platform of the 1880s that was the high point of this idea. It's called Classical Reform Judaism. Now, the minute the Pittsburgh platform was written, there was a counter-reaction. A lot of Jews didn't like it. The same time frame that the Pittsburgh platform came out, Jews, conservative Orthodox Jews in New York, founded Jewish Theological Seminary, and every reaction produces an equal and opposite counter-reaction, and so we're still having this debate. We're still having this debate. How much should Jews care about themselves, but how much of the outreach, how much is Judaism associated with social justice? As you saw, the Pew Research Center says a bare majority of Jews do seem to feel that social justice is, in the broadest sense, a central tenet of Judaism, and but a lot of people don't, and we'll continue debating it. I think it's what I try to do in my book is give voice to various sides of this. I have three Orthodox Jewish dear friends who read my book because I wanted to make sure that I was respectful to all sides and write a book that just is history and tells about these debates. So my final takeaway, I want to leave a little bit of time to hear your questions, is that it's very similar to what the rabbi was saying, that I, as a journalist, I think that, we're at a very divisive moment in Jewish history, let's face it. And many of us in this room might even disagree about the extent of that social justice is a part of Judaism. Do you have to be against Trump if you're Jewish and all of that? I guess my takeaway when I'm asked is that I like what I discovered or rediscovered in writing this book is that the history of Judaism is the history of conflicts within Judaism. And we have to cherish that part of our history as well. Going back to the earliest eras of the rabbinic era of the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the Zealots and the Essenes and the Gospels of Jesus, which were codified around the same time as rabbinic Judaism was flourishing, But, you know, going into, I mean, there were the Hellenizers versus the Maccabees, you know, and Hanukkah is portrayed as a triumph of Jews over the Greek civilization, but as many of you know, it was really a civil war among Jews where the Maccabees were kind of like the Taliban of their day. They were enforcing Jews' religious laws on Jews. And then in the late 19th century, the revival of Hanukkah was actually a product of the Orthodox counter-revolution against the Reform. It was the Orthodox Jews who wanted to revive Hanukkah to revive the idea of the importance of the temple. And so when we, you know, celebrate Hanukkah and the saving of the temple, we, you know, do we really pray for the revival of the temple? I don't know, maybe some of us do, but the centrality of the temple in Jerusalem is what Hanukkah was about and how the revival was about. And then there were many other eras of conflict. Even, let's face it, among ultra-Orthodox Jews, you know that all these various sects hate each other. The Hasids are now they're fighting in New York between the measles and the anti-measles faction. This is our heritage as much as anything else. So the lesson that I leave you with is why I love history, which is that if we listen to the voices of history, maybe we'll be a little more tolerant. You know, we have to listen to each other, don't we? And we have to do that today. And I think history helps us listen to each other. That's why I wanted to write this book. And I thank you very much for listening to me. So do we have time for a few questions?
We absolutely do, yeah. Thank you so much, Steve.
So bring it on.
Yes.
Well, I was just reflecting on what you were saying about history. So I grew up as a Reformed Jew, so I can validate how I feel about tzedakah and tikkun olam, which I guess are two components of
right.
what we're talking about for social justice. But what are you finding like with the conservative movement and the Orthodox movement and the Chabad movement? Are most everybody on board with this, or is there a lot of controversy?
I think it's pretty controversial within the Orthodox community, but I would say the conservative movement is pretty much wedded to Tikkun Olam. And just a word about Tikkun Olam, which is such an interesting phrase. It is an ancient one, going back to the rabbinic era, but there's absolutely no connection between the phrase as it was enunciated in the Talmudic era and what we have today. It basically, to be honest, was hijacked by the kind of the reform social justice advocates. They took this ancient phrase, which mostly is associated with Jewish mysticism, not entirely, but you know, the vessels coming together, and but I think it's pretty widely shared in the Reform and conservative branches, and some in Orthodox. It's funny, when I was when my book came out last year, my beloved friend David Shribman, who's the editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, asked me to write a big cover story for their Sunday feature section about my book. And he said, can you make it a little bit about Pittsburgh? And I happily did. And I even mentioned, this was before the tragedy of last year, the Tree of Life Synagogue, which is a conservative synagogue. But if you go to their website, you'll see that Tikkun Olam is a very much a part of them. But I will say this, that I don't think that social justice alone is enough for Jews. And I think that we would all agree. So I think that what you're seeing in Judaism now is a revival of trying to rediscover and then revive and re-embrace our traditions. And that's why in the Reform movement, there's so much return to tradition, to tradition, you know, wearing yarmulkes and talit and all of that. So it's very fluid right now. Anyway, I want to keep the answer short. Anyone else? No one disagrees? Okay.
No question.
Go ahead.
But I read your book, because there was a great big review in the Charleston paper.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Half a page.
Yeah.
And then I come because it was more interested in the Reform movement, of which I'm not part of. I called the synagogue to see if they had it in their library, and they didn't, but they ordered it for me, and then they delivered it to me. So I'm the first person to read the book from that library.
It is in our library.
I know, it's the book she ordered for me.
Because I haven't checked out right now.
Well, you could go and buy another one.
I think I might have to do that.
It wouldn't be so bad.
Today.
What would be so bad? Charleston, you know, this is not my first visit to Charleston. I came with my wife and children here in 2008. Elizabeth was reminding me last night, I couldn't remember what year it was. But she works for the New York Times. She's the Washington Bureau chief of the New York Times, I'm proud to say. And she was covering McCain, and somehow she was down here, and then we decided to go out to, you know, the beach, and we spent a lot of time in Charleston at restaurants. But we also went to Beth Elohim, and I spent, you know, part of an afternoon there visiting and reading the literature that's there, and that kind of awakened speeded along my interest in writing this book. I think most people associate the Reform movement with German Jews who came, and that's true, that in the 19th century there were only 250,000 Jews in the United States, and although the first Jews who came in the 17th century were Sephardim, and the first Jews, I think, in Charleston were Sephardim, because it was a port city and engaged in the trading in the Caribbean, in the Dutch tradition. It's interesting, a lot of people don't realize that the Sephardim were among the earliest reformers, and there's a lot of fascinating literature about this, about why the Sephardim embraced Reform, and it wasn't just the German Jews that did so. And some of it has to do with the fact that in the Spanish Inquisition, when Jews were undercover in Spain, the only Bible that they had was the they had the Old Testament and the New Testament, and they read the Old Testament, but they didn't have any evidence of Talmudic scholarship, or, you know, they didn't study. They just studied the Bible. And when a lot of these Jews went to the Netherlands after the Inquisition, they were shocked that there was all this mumbo-jumbo, Talmudic mumbo-jumbo that they didn't, kind of forgot or didn't know were a part of Judaism, and many of them didn't like it. So, Spinoza was one of those Jews who came from a family that had escaped from Spain or from wherever, Iberia, to the Netherlands, and was, of course, the revolutionary in the 17th century, friend of Descartes, and he was excommunicated for saying that Jews were not the chosen people. So, my watch is there, but I think we're at the witching hour. Thank you very much. One more question.
Okay, I've not been prompted by anybody. Could you repeat the name of the book?
Yes, it's The Chosen Wars.
The Chosen
Wars. The Chosen Wars, which is obviously a kind of play on words, like chosenness and wars of choice. Again, thank you very much.